Hi, my name's Noreen Jamil, and this is...
Emily Kate Stevens.
Both of us have been diagnosed with long COVID.
And we've created this podcast dedicated to the condition. Welcome to the Long COVID Sessions. Hello, love. How are you? How was your week?
Before we logged on this morning, I was just thinking about that, and I can't think of anything.
No.
It's not been horrendously bad, but I've not felt well. My insomnia is really bad. I think it's as bad as it was when I first got long COVID.
Did you have insomnia from the moment you got COVID? Because that was one of the first things that I noticed. I got COVID, and even with the active infection and feeling awful, I stopped sleeping, and I then didn't sleep for about 2.5 years. Is that similar to what happened to you?
I've always been a bad sleeper.
Okay.
But COVID made it so much worse.
Right.
And then I had those instances of waking up breathless, you know, like you've stopped breathing in your sleep.
Yeah.
So you're panting. That's not what I'm having right now. What I'm having right now is that I'm falling asleep and then waking up 1.5 to 2 hours later, and then that's it.
Just not tired.
My feet are restless. My feet burn. I feel hot. I strip off. I'll open the window. And then it'll take a while for my body to calm down, and then I can fall back asleep for maybe 45 minutes, and then I have to get up for school.
That sounds really rubbish.
It does.
For both of us, we say that the COVID was the catalyst, but do you think it can be a hormonal thing? Have you spoken to someone about your hormone levels and things?
Well, I mentioned I'd been to see my gynecologist, but she's like, you're on the flight path now to menopause, you know, late 40s, and there you go. Perimenopause, and here we are.
And that's it. You just have to deal with insomnia for the next 10 years.
All kinds of things, apparently. I mean, I've had insomnia now for the past almost 4 years, on and off, with long COVID. And before that, I don't know if it was insomnia or just I didn't need very much sleep to get through my day. I really didn't.
That's what I was like. I would have 5-6 hours sleep a night, and I didn't feel this overwhelming exhaustion, and it didn't ever feel like insomnia because I was fine. But some people might hear our conversation and say this is possibly not a trigger for the long COVID, but one of the things that was in our systems that has somehow let the long COVID happen to us, that we obviously didn't sleep very much in our pre-long COVID years. I never did.
No, me neither. We're all different, aren't we? This is something I've learned has come home really to roost with me, is the idea that we're all very different and we all have different levels
of
what we need, not only in terms of biomarkers, but also in terms of energy. But you need to do more exercise than I do to feel well. I need less sleep to be able to get through my day and not feel tired.
Yeah.
So we are all individual, but there must be a common thread on this with the insomnia.
Yeah.
And tell me, my love, how are you?
So we're a little overdue putting this out because I had a little crash over half term. I was not great. But then I had a couple of weeks where I felt really good. So I was in my, I've beaten this. Anyway, I had an MRI on Friday and I've had a horrendous reaction to it. I think it's to the gadolinium. Obviously, we don't know. But I have ended up with a kidney infection now. So I don't feel great from that. Obviously, that is not necessarily long COVID. But what I would say from that is, one, the MRI is because they sent me to a gastroenterologist for the long COVID. Two, I don't think that we really understand all of the things that the long COVID has knocked out of whack in our bodies. And I now react to anything that seems to be injected into my body. Remember those first iron infusions that I had a similar reaction, actually. I ended up with diarrhea and vomiting for weeks. But this reaction was extreme and it was violent. It was like a proper Marie Kondo of my insides, like aggressively cleansing absolutely everything. And it hasn't yet stopped. So,
oh, God.
Yeah, I think that when you go for these procedures and they don't consider talking to you fully about the potential side effects of the things that they're putting into your body, I think that's a problem when you are someone that possibly has sensitivities to anything that's put into your body, because I then had to wait until after the weekend to speak to the department to find out what it even was that they had injected into me.
That's crazy. You are super sensitive to everything.
Yeah.
When you said to me that you'd had a reaction, I then looked up gadolinium, which I hadn't really done before, despite having very mild reactions to it. I've had several MRIs with contrast because mm-hmm. I've had heart issues. And then I was telling you about my mum. Her blood pressure just crashed and she almost was unconscious. We had to call an ambulance out for her after the gadolinium.
And yet, did they give her any warning before? Nope. They just give you that dye like it's nothing. They ask you if you have a known heart condition. I think that's the only thing they asked me.
Was it the one that makes you feel like you're going to wet yourself? Warm feeling.
It made me feel like I was going to have diarrhea whilst I was in the MRI thing. And I said that to the radiographer. And she was like, it's fine. You can just wait. And then from the moment that I came out of that MRI, I basically didn't get off the leave for 24 hours straight.
Oh my God.
But when I called the hospital about it, apparently, no, people don't really have a reaction to gadolinium. Oh no, if you look it up, our friend Dr. Internet, it seems that multiple scientific studies suggest that people do have reactions to it.
And it stays in you, apparently. Yeah. Like small deposits in your brain.
Yeah.
Apart from that, I don't even know if you could tell me, because you've just been feeling so bad.
Oh, and this was pain. By 3 days in, this was pain worse than childbirth.
Oh.
And I gave birth to two children without pain relief, and this was worse. The only thing I can compare it to is when I had kidney stones. It literally felt like my insides were being ripped out.
Are you on antibiotics for your kidney infection?
Yeah, I'm on antibiotics now, but it's still like I'm being kicked in the back, in my back, up near my ribs. It was lower down and it's moved up. So the thing with that is that I could have been slightly annoyed, because I actually felt like I was doing quite well before this kicked in, and I was feeling really strong. I was feeling physically strong and mentally strong. However, the way I'm viewing this is, okay, this infection, my body has to mount a full-on offense to deal with this infection. And what it's going to do is it's going to get rid of the viral residue or COVID residue from my body. I don't need an immunologist to call in and say that your body can't do that, okay? Because this is what I'm going to believe, that it's going to cleanse my body and I'm going to be fine after this.
Well, that's as good a theory as I've heard over the past 4 years. So let's hope.
Well, I live in hope, don't I?
So. You do. You live in this great space, actually. I like it. Apart from when you are about to have a crash and then it's all very dark.
Very dark, isn't it? With this, it was quite dark when it was so painful.
And did the hospital offer any advice when you said, like, I'm really suffering?
No. No, they said that people don't normally react like that, but if I wanted, I could raise a complaint. I said, right now, I just want to understand what's going on with my body. At that point, when I called them, I just needed to know how to rectify or what I needed to do.
Was it drink lots of water?
Well, they didn't give me any advice. I had to get to my GP, who was great. And I didn't say to him what had happened. I said, I had an MRI on Friday, and he said, it sounds like you've had a reaction to the gadolinium. Even if the MRI people don't think that that happens, the GP seems to have seen it before.
People just probably go to their GPs.
Yeah. So?
So my daughter has been feeling unwell for a few days. She's been having these headaches. She's not feeling great. So I took her to the doctor. And the doctor was concerned enough to send her for blood work. And I just looked at the results. But 15-year-old girl, pretty normal. And her iron level is in the toilet. So she doesn't have long COVID, touch wood.
But she's had period changes from COVID.
Period changes from COVID, yeah. They've become extremely heavy and she's only young, which brings us on nicely to our guest.
Yeah, our guest this week, which was quite an eye-opening interview about something that really is kind of basic in the medical field, it seems, when he explains it. Dr. Angie Klein is an anaesthetist at the Royal Papworth Hospital in Cambridge, and he also runs the Cambridge Iron Clinic, which deals with B12 and iron deficiency.
And he's seeing a lot of long COVID patients.
It's remarkable, the overlap of symptoms.
But what he had to say was remarkable in that who knew that being iron deficient or B12 deficient could lead your body to have very similar symptoms to long COVID. And that a lot of people with long COVID also are iron deficient and B12 deficient.
You say that you have people who are diagnosed with long COVID who have the same symptoms as iron and B12 deficiency.
Correct.
Can you just for us evaluate what long COVID symptoms are the same as iron and B12 deficiency? Where are the similarities?
It's so remarkably similar, all three conditions. And I've taken the long COVID symptoms to the NHS.uk website. I've taken the pernicious anemia or B12 deficiency symptoms from the Pernicious Anemia Society website. So there's two patient help groups in the UK, and they're called the Pernicious Anemia Society and the B12 Deficiency Society. And they're charities that patients who have been looked after and got better, who help other patients. So they've set up these charities to provide help and support. And they have a website, and on it, their patients put down their symptoms. And then I've also put the iron deficiency symptoms from patients who did a Facebook survey. We conducted a Facebook survey of 1,000 patients with iron deficiency and asked what their symptoms were and sort of collated them all in order of frequency. So those that were the most frequent downwards. And so the number one symptom that people present with when they've got long COVID or pernicious anemia or iron deficiency is fatigue. So that is across the board in all three conditions. And then the second most common symptom is shortness of breath, palpitations, dizziness, fainting, difficulty sleeping, brain fog, pins and needles, joint pain, depression and anxiety.
Yeah, you are literally reading the long COVID. Those symptoms listed in every single article on
correct.
Long COVID in the order
and
that they present.
Every single patient who presents with pernicious anemia and iron deficiency has those symptoms in order of frequency. So in other words, when I look at 1,000 patients with confirmed iron deficiency, those are their top 10 symptoms. And if you list the Pernicious Anemia Society and the B12 Society, what their patients say on their survey, it's exactly the same. Even things like change in taste, sensory loss, loss of taste, smell or hearing, which is a classic long COVID symptom, pernicious anemia or B12 patients get that.
All right, there's so many questions I have right now. So let's start with the first one. Explain to our listeners what is anemia, because Emily and I, we have these fights with our GP every few months about what is deficiency and what isn't.
Yeah, and there's also pernicious anemia, anemia and iron deficiency are all three
okay,
different
good.
Things, aren't they?
So anemia on its own is a reduction in the number of red blood cells. So a reduced concentration of red blood cells, less red blood cells. But that is actually very rare in my patients. Very few of my patients are anemic, less than 5%. So actually, is anemia is a term that we're not going to use for the rest of this discussion because so few of my patients have anemia. It's better to use the words B12 or iron deficiency.
And yet the GP is pretty much not willing to treat you or look at you unless you classify as anemic in terms of your iron deficiency.
And yet I have treated probably several thousand patients and maybe only less than 5% have anemia. And this is a big problem. The symptoms come from the deficiency of these critical micronutrients, not from the anemia. So patients with B12 deficiency have a deficiency of B12, which is why it's much better to refer to it as B12 deficiency, because the words say what it is. And patients with B12 deficiency, B12 is a critical micronutrient that's used to heal the nerves. So when you have B12 deficiency, you have nerve symptoms. And every single symptom I listed you is because of either damage or injury to the nerves that the body can't heal. So B12 deficiency, if we go through those symptoms I said, your brain is full of gazillions of nerves. And when they're not healing properly, you suffer from brain symptoms like fatigue, like brain fog, headaches, dizziness. All those are symptoms from the brain being deficient in B12. And things like pins and needles, tingling, numbness, that's due to the nerves supplying the various parts of the body, especially the fingers and the toes and then the arms and the legs and maybe the face or the scalp. All those are nerve damage caused by B12 deficiency. And things like loss of taste or smell, the cranial nerves that supply your face and your eyes. So you get visual disturbances, hearing disturbances, tinnitus, loss of taste or smell or hearing, tingling on the side of your face. All these things. So patients present to an eye appointment to say, I've got blurred vision, or they have tinnitus, or they have...
Noreen, we talk about all of these things
all the time.
I don't even know that I've been tested for B12.
It's absolutely critical. So all these symptoms are caused by nerve damage. And then things like shortness of breath and palpitations, they're caused by the sympathetic and the parasympathetic nerves that supply your inner organs, your heart and your lungs and your stomach and things. They get damaged as well. So you get gastrointestinal symptoms like diarrhea, abdominal pain, anything in your internal organs, shortness of breath, palpitations, all those are caused by B12 deficiency. So you can see B12 is a big issue.
So what is B12? How do you get it? And then how do you become deficient? What's the mechanism?
B12 is a micronutrient. There's several of the B vitamins that are micronutrients. There's B1, B3, B6, B9, which is folic acid, which we know more commonly, and then B12. And these are all micronutrients. They're vitamins that we absorb from our food, and they're only found in animal products. There is no B12, zero B12 in plants and plant-based products. So if you're a vegan, you consume zero B12.
Wow. Is that something that's actually becoming more of an issue than more people become vegetarian or vegan?
Correct. And we've written several articles about this and the importance of nutrition in providing B12 and other micronutrients. So if you're a vegan, and it's a very healthy lifestyle, I'm not criticizing vegan diets as a lifestyle choice, but there is zero B12 in plant material. So B12 is called cobalamin, and it's an essential nutrient required for growth and neurological development. And it's in our food, but it's only in animal products. So we get it from meat, but also fish and eggs and milk and cheese. But there is zero B12 in a vegan diet. So all vegans need to supplement with B12, and especially if they're pregnant, because they're also supplying B12 to their baby. It's actually an enantiomer. So it's a complex compound that has two mirror images of itself, and the inactive and the active form are the simple terms for those two enantiomers. And you may be able to absorb the inactive form, but not the active form, due to certain conditions which lead to B12 deficiency. So, for example, inflammation of the stomach, inflammatory bowel disease, too much acid, too little acid in the stomach, or taking proton pump inhibitors that stop the acid production in the stomach, they all stop you absorbing the active form of B12, which requires something called intrinsic factor, which is normally in our stomach when it's healthy. So if you're healthy, your stomach is a biome, it's a complex environment, and you absorb things nicely when you're healthy. But when you're unhealthy, your stomach biome is deranged and you lack intrinsic factor and you can't absorb B12. So many patients with long COVID have a problem with their stomach.
And can that unhealthiness that you describe be something like you've been hit by a virus?
Correct.
Okay. So just on that note of absorption, when we have our blood tested and our levels checked for various different things, are the figures that we get there indicative of the way our body is able to absorb these nutrients, or are they almost arbitrary in some respects?
Almost
in
terms arbitrary. Of the blood test is absolutely useless. So if I tell you the blood test that we do for B12 has a sensitivity of 30%. So if you did 10 people, if you tested their B12, it would detect B12 deficiency in 3 of those 10 patients. That's what sensitivity of 30% is. That means 7 people with B12 deficiency would have a normal blood test result.
So when you're looking for B12 deficiency, are you saying that you listen to your patients instead of just looking at the blood result?
Gosh, what an amazing concept that is. Yes, because only three of them will be picked up by the blood test. If someone has a very low B12 level, and that definition of low B12 level varies around the world. So in the UK, it also varies around the UK by postcode, depending on how much service or treatment is allocated by postcode. So if you look in certain parts of the country like Yorkshire, B12 is defined as a less than 150. If you look in other parts of the country, like maybe Cambridgeshire, it's defined by less than 180. How you define a range, so a normal range is defined as two standard deviations of the population in your area. So 95% of your population will fall between a B12 of, say, 180 and 800. So that range is very broad because it's defined by the population normal. And of course, the population of Yorkshire will have different demographics to the population of Cambridgeshire, which will have different demographics to the population of London, and so on and so forth. So the normal range is 95% of the population, but it's not defined by any disease processes or symptoms. So actually, the normal range is entirely useless for defining disease, or in this case, B12 deficiency. It only defines you whether you sit in the 95% population interval. So when I say a normal range, it's a nonsense. But in the UK, the NHS uses the normal range to allocate treatment. So you would not get treated in Yorkshire unless you fall in the lowest 2.5% of the population, which is below 150. Whereas many people will have symptoms and the disease if they have a B12 of 160, 180, 200, 250. For example, in Japan, the treatment range is a B12 of less than 400.
And is that a money thing? Is that because the NHS doesn't want to dole out B12?
Quite possibly. You'd have to ask the NHS that question. It's also to do with education and the way we look at nutrient deficiencies, what we believe in, what our understanding our conditions. So it's due to education, training, and also resource use. So as I say, in Japan it's 400, in Germany it's 300. In my head it's 300. So anyone with a B12 of less than 300 who has those symptoms, I'm going to be looking to treat. And really the number one thing that you hit on, Emily, is it's actually important to listen to the patient and get their symptoms. So what's more important than a number, and I'm sure everyone listening to this would say, I'm much more important than a number, is those symptoms. So the first thing you need to do is get a list of symptoms and see how they fit in. So on all those websites and mine, I list all those symptoms and I ask patients to tick off and to list what they feel in terms of those symptoms and to grade them. How bad is your numbers? Well, I can't feel a thing. Or it's just a bit of pins and needles. How bad is your visual effect? You know, my eyesight's fine or it's really blurry and it's getting worse. So really the number one thing is the symptoms of the patient. And then you then go on to do a blood test. Now, I told you it lacks sensitivity. There's another complicating factor. Anything that you ingest, eat, drink, with vitamin B in it makes the blood test useless. So because of this active and inactive B12, any B vitamin makes the blood test overread. So there's B vitamins in multivitamins. There's B vitamins in Marmite. There's B vitamins in breakfast cereal, in oat milk. Many, many things. A lot of vegan foods have vitamin B added to them to supplement them. And if you're eating any of those things or ingesting multivitamins or supplements, your B blood test is useless.
And that's not just B12 in those things. It's any B vitamins.
Because of this fact that the blood test only just looks at a B vitamin. It looks at cobalamin, and there's cobalamin in all the B vitamins. So the blood test means that anyone who's having oat milk with their coffee or is taking a multivitamin supplement, or is having breakfast cereal every morning, and virtually all breakfast cereals are supplemented with B vitamin, that blood test will show a much higher level than the true value. And that's why the sensitivity is so low. So if you have oat milk with your cereal, the B12 blood test is a waste of time.
And is it in normal milk as well?
No.
Okay.
It contains natural B12, but it's not supplemented. It's this artificial supplementation that comes from non-animal products that is not the active form of B12. So it affects the blood test, but it doesn't help the patient.
Okay. Now, in terms of helping the patient, is the solution, if you tick off all of these things on your list, is the solution to take a B12 supplement? Is it to make dietary changes? And if you take a B12 supplement, is that going to be taken up by your body?
Well, this is a hugely controversial area. So the problem is fundamentally that you can't absorb the active components of the B12 from your stomach if you have B12 deficiency. So if you're healthy and your stomach is healthy and you take a multivitamin or a supplement, then yes, you will absorb B12 because you have intrinsic factor in your stomach and you're able to convert it into the active B12 and use it. So if you are healthy and you supplement or you take a multivitamin, then yes. If you are unhealthy, if your gut is unhealthy and there's too much acid or too little acid, or you've had COVID and your gut has been affected quite badly in many people, or you have autoimmune disease and you produce autoantibodies against your stomach, or you have inflammation in your gut. So autoimmune disease could be hypothyroidism, Hashimoto's, it could be SLE, lupus, it could be rheumatoid arthritis, it could be type 1 diabetes, it could be Sjögren syndrome. There's about 60 autoimmune conditions. All of these things affect the intrinsic factor in your stomach and stop you absorbing B12. So taking supplements or multivitamins orally will not work. So the simple answer is healthy guts, yes. Unhealthy guts, no. The oral supplements and the multivitamins are a waste of time. You will only absorb the inactive part and you will not get better.
Oh dear.
Is this the same in iron? Because I read a statement that you'd made previously saying iron tablets can be a waste of time in many patients.
Correct.
Okay, exactly. So when we get onto iron, we'll discuss that as well.
Exactly the same. You need an acidic environment in your stomach with a healthy biome and lots of intrinsic factor. And they're all co-absorbed together, iron, folic acid, vitamin D and B12. So most of my patients are lower in all those four things. Now, so the controversy comes is if you take an incredibly high amount of oral B12, something like 5 milligrams a day, then you may be able to absorb some of it. So you flood the gut with oral B12. So many people will prescribe oral B12 at a very high dose, and you may absorb some of it. So, you know, 100 times the normal dose in a supplement or a multivitamin. And it's the same thing with iron. You take a massive dose, you might absorb some of it. So the GPs will often, first line, go for a very big dose of oral B12 to try and get you to absorb some of it. Because, of course, taking something by tablet is very easy and very cheap. So in some people, taking a massive dose of oral B12 will work. It will just force its way past their gut that's not working very well.
Is that okay to flood your... Are there negative effects of taking that high dose?
No, because you want to try and absorb some of it. So, you know, you might excrete 98%, but if you can absorb 2% of it, then that's definitely better than nothing. But the unfortunate thing is that many people, however much oral B12 they take, they can't absorb enough active B12 to get better. So really then for them, the only solution is to take the B12, we call it parenterally, by injection. In other words, we bypass the stomach and you have B12 injections so that you don't need the intrinsic factor or the stomach or the gut to absorb the B12. So you need to give yourself regular injections. And we've been injecting B12 for 60 or 70 years. So this is not a new thing. B12 deficiency is a very old disease that we've known how to treat for many, many years. So people who cannot absorb oral B12 and who have symptoms despite oral supplementation need injections, basically.
So my dad, he gets the injections. He must have a very low B12 level for him to get it. My mum has a low B12 and she's got RA, but they won't give her the injections.
Yes, correct. And that's the thing I hear from many, many, many patients. So as I said to you, how low is low? The trigger would probably be 150. To 180 in most places in the UK. And therefore, if she's not quite low enough, she won't get the injections. But I said to you, you can still get symptoms at a level of 250. So it wouldn't trigger injections, but you can still have symptoms.
Well, she's got neuropathy because of her RA as well.
If she had neuropathy and a B12 of less than 300, then I would definitely be looking to give her injections. And I would expect that to improve her neuropathy. And even if she had neuropathy and her B12 level was 600 because she was supplementing orally, I would still be looking to try her with injections. So the big thing about B12 injections is they're not toxic. They're not dangerous. They're not harmful in any way, shape or form.
And are you able to get them at these clinics? Obviously at your clinic via the hospital, but you know, you hear of all these fads that the Kardashians are doing, for example. Are you able to go down perhaps on a high street and get a B12 injection?
Yes.
Oh, good.
So many, many places offer B12 injections around the country. So dentists, health and beauty practitioners, clinics that offer injections like fillers or Botox, pharmacists.
Sounds a bit healthier than having Botox.
Much healthier, yeah. The big thing about that, Noreen, is it costs money. So they will buy the B12 usually from abroad. So in many countries in the world, B12 is sold over the counter. In the UK, it's a prescription-only medicine. So the MHRA, the Medicines and Healthcare Regulatory Authority, they have designated B12 as a prescription-only medicine in the UK. In Germany, it is an over-the-counter medicine. So if you walk into a pharmacy in Frankfurt and you ask for 100 doses of B12, they will give you 100 doses of B12 and they'll charge you 100 euros. So it costs 1 euro per dose of B12. So many people in Germany self-inject with B12, go to their pharmacy, buy it and give it.
I think our road trip might have got even longer, Noreen, now. Now we're going to Germany on the way to California.
So you walk into a German pharmacy, you can buy 100 doses of B12 for 100 euros. So it's 1 euro a dose. If you walk into a pharmacy in the UK, you can't get B12. It's a prescription-only medicine. So you need a prescription. And in the UK, it costs about £4 a dose because it's a licensed prescription-only medicine.
But we can do it at places that offer the injections. So you can go and have it injected by someone who is registered to do such.
They go and buy the B12, usually in Germany. They bring it back to their clinic. They will charge you a cost that's commensurate with them obtaining a supply of B12 and getting the syringe and needle and injecting and disposing of it. So normally, in many places in the UK, you can go and get it for £30.
And how long do the injections last? I think my dad gets them 6 monthly.
So that is we could spend the next hour talking about that as well. So B12 is excreted in about 6 hours. After an injection, you excrete most of it in 6 hours. So during that time, you use it to heal your body and you might put a tiny bit of it in storage. So you don't have much storage. So people who are stable on their medication, been having it for years, they only need it every few months, like your father, for example. But people who at the beginning of their treatment, when they're very low, they need it very frequently, usually every 2 days. So when I start people off on B12 injections, I start them off injections every other day. And according to the NICE guidelines, so NICE is the National Institute for Healthcare Excellence, they're reviewing the B12 guidelines currently, and they're just about to be published in February or March. According to them, you need B12 every other day until your neurological symptoms are better. And then you can then reduce the dose. In other words, you need a lot at the beginning and then not very much. So I would say at the beginning, every other day until the neurological symptoms go away, and then you can reduce it to less frequently. Now that, of course, is a very expensive prescription for the NHS to provide because you need to have an appointment every other day with a nurse to go and give you an injection. So the B12 itself might not be expensive, but that is extremely resource heavy because it requires a 15 or 10 minute appointment with a nurse every other day. That's 3 times a week.
Can they not teach you how to self-inject?
Correct. So I teach all my patients to self-inject, give them a prescription for some boxes of B12 and sign them off and they self-inject.
Okay, Emily, we don't have to go to Germany. We just have to go and see Dr. Klein.
It's like Cambridge.
Or just get some B12. So many of the self-help groups in the UK, they help people to get B12, teach them to self-inject, and they're off they go. So I would say there's this huge black market. And black market is the wrong term because it's not illegal to have B12 and it's not illegal to self-inject. But there's this huge black market where hundreds of thousands of people in the UK are self-injecting with B12 because they can't get the number of injections they need for the NHS because we're resource constrained. So it's a very, very difficult condition because you need lots of injections You have to self-inject, but then diabetics self-inject four times a day.
And I understand what you're saying, that that's resource heavy and potentially expensive in terms of prescription. But in the long run, if you could save multiple people from having to have other treatment, testing and so forth, if this was something that you could try before more invasive or more extensive therapies or investigations, it would save in the long run.
You'd think so. You need to be a health economist to prove it, because we're talking here about hundreds and hundreds of thousands of patients. And this would be a very expensive treatment. But these hundreds of thousands of people are suffering lots of symptoms, and some of them can't work, or they can't do things at home, or they struggle to, you know, they're ill. They can't go out of the house, perhaps in more extreme conditions. So really, the counter of the argument is there's lots of people who are suffering. We know that there's a safe, effective treatment in B12, but it's a very costly treatment in terms of resource use. And we know that many treatments have to be resource constrained. And there's a huge amount of controversy about B12. There has been for many, many years. And there are a lot of doctors, and you could talk to another doctor instead of Dr. Andy, who would say B12 is not at all important and you don't need very much of it. And this is all a nonsense. So I have to acknowledge that there's a lot of controversy about this. What I'm telling you is my view based on my interpretation of the literature and my patient experience. But another person would tell you that it's a load of nonsense and B12 is a nonsense. And there's like this in medicine with many, many conditions. There's differences of interpretation of the literature, differences in experience and differences in practice. Medicine is not black and white, it's nuanced.
Now, before we get into talking about the actual figures of the efficacy that you've seen with your B12 treatment, could we do the same thing for iron? And can you tell us, you said that we are not looking at anemia. Could you tell us what iron deficiency is? Its symptoms, its causes?
Yeah, very simply, a deficiency in iron, not enough iron. So iron is a very important molecule that is attached to the red blood cells and attaches to the oxygen. So the only function of your red blood cells, really, or 99% of their function, is to carry oxygen around your body. So your heart pumps the red blood cells around, your lungs take in the oxygen, it's attached to the red blood cells and it's pumped around your body, to your brain, to your organs, to your limbs. And so when you exercise, your heart rate goes up and you breathe harder to get more and more oxygen in, to pump more oxygen around to your muscles. So you start breathing heavier and your heart pumps more quickly and more forcefully. So that really is the function of red blood cells. So of course, if you don't have enough red blood cells, you don't get enough oxygen. And that's why anemia is we talked about. But if you don't have enough iron, you can't attach the oxygen to your red blood cells. So you would have less molecules of oxygen whizzing around your body, and therefore, you're oxygen deprived. So the symptoms of iron deficiency are those of oxygen deprivation. So if I go through that top 10 that I read out to you at the beginning of our discussion, fatigue, lack of oxygen to your brain, shortness of breath, your lungs feeling like they need to provide more oxygen to the system because so you feel short of breath all the time. You feel oxygen hungry, palpitations. That's your heart racing to try and provide more oxygen to your body. Dizziness, fainting, that's, you know, lack of oxygen. Brain fog, lack of oxygen. Pins and needles, you get this lack of oxygen in your fingers. You get pain in your muscles because of lack of oxygen. So athletes, when they have iron deficiency, they run and they go lactic much more quickly because they have a lack of oxygen to your brain. So if you're an athlete, a runner or a cyclist, and you have low iron levels, you go lactic when you exercise much more quickly. Your maximum heart rate goes up. Your muscles then become swollen. You build up a lactic acid oxygen debt. And then you get injuries and you get aching muscles and you get restless legs in bed as you get rid of that lactic acid. This is all extremely well described by every sporting body that runs athlete program, from the British Olympic Organization to professional footballers to professional athletes in any description. So iron is an incredibly important thing because it carries oxygen around your body. So all those symptoms I described to you can be caused by iron deficiency. and depression and anxiety because you're just always feeling oxygen deprived.
What about changes to nails, hair, skin, those kind of things?
Dry skin, hair falling out. That's hair falling out because it happens at a ferritin of 75 because your hair follicles die and your hair falls out because of a lack of oxygen. So your hair follicles are an end organ. They're right at the end of all those blood vessels. They're very difficult to get oxygen to. So your hair falls out when you're iron deficient because your hair follicles die. Your nails become ridged because your nail beds are damaged by the lack of oxygen. Your skin becomes dry and flaky. So all those symptoms are attributable to low oxygen. And of course, many of them are very similar to the symptoms of long COVID.
So how low is low?
Ah, now this comes back to the same discussion that we've had. So there are various definitions by various bodies. So first of all, you have the 95% confidence interval, where the normal range that a laboratory or a GP would quote to you would probably be 10 to 400. And of course, that might differ by postcode, but it's around that. So that is 95% of the population would have a ferritin, because that's our measure of iron stores, a ferritin of 10 to 400. But 20% of women premenopausal, that is still having periods, have an iron deficiency. So if you do the math, that means 17.5% of women will have a normal, in inverted commas, ferritin, but have iron deficiency. So they would have a ferritin of 20 or 30. So the British Committee for Standards in Haematology defines severe iron deficiency as a ferritin of less than 30.
So when I go to the doctor and I have a ferritin level of 12 and I'm told I'm okay, that's nonsense.
You're not okay.
And mine's 9.
My one last year was 7.
That's severe iron deficiency. And when it's less than 10, you're crunching on ice. So the symptom that is absolutely has the highest sensitivity, 98% sensitivity and specificity, is pica, P-I-C-A. That's when you crave foods and cold water, fizzy water and ice. So when your ferritin is less than 10, if I go into a pub and I see a woman, because unfortunately 19 out of 20 people with iron deficiency are women, and that's biological because of periods and babies, they go into a pub and they order a glass of ice because it's the only thing that makes their mouth taste better. So craving fizzy water, cold water, ice, chickpeas, and in the olden days, in the 19th century, coal dust and rolled up newspaper, crunched up newspaper. Those are all pica.
I actually was chewing on coffee beans for ages. I had no idea why I was chewing
on
coffee
beans. So that's pica, severe iron deficiency. So less than 10 is pica. 10 to 30 is all those other symptoms. Most patients start to get a few symptoms at 50, and they have marked symptoms at 30, and less than 10 is really bad.
So I don't understand then why the doctors are like, you're fine, on you go. And these levels are with taking iron supplements.
But those iron supplements are not working.
Yeah, obviously.
So if your stomachs were working well, your iron supplements would work. And if you started with a ferritin of 9 and you took iron supplements for 3 months, it should be 40, right? Anything that you take to treat iron deficiency should work.
Oral iron makes me so sick. It literally makes me vomit.
And that's because of your stomach. So a lot of people can't tolerate oral iron. I'd say it's between 30 and 50% according to the literature. So that means one third of women, they can't take it because of sickness, vomiting, diarrhea and constipation and pain and bloating. So that's one third of women cannot use oral iron. And then a lot of other people can tolerate it, it just doesn't work. So you take it for 6 months and you put up with a bit of constipation and your ferritin is still 12 or 15. And this is because oral iron is a really imperfect drug. And there are many, 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 many formulations. Lots of people have tried to make a good formulation of oral iron. And none of them, as far as I can work out, work very well. There are probably 20 that you could find on Amazon or an online chemist now. And most of them just don't work. There are some very expensive forms that have been coated in various things to try and make them work. And there are some studies to show that some of the most expensive ones might work a bit better. But oral iron is an imperfect drug. So Emily, if it makes your tummy hurt and it makes you sick, you can't take oral iron. It doesn't work.
I know I have had iron infusions over the last 3 years, but the fight, I've done it once privately, but the fight to do that on the NHS is a battle. And when you're feeling rubbish, it is not necessarily something that you even have the energy to do.
No, and the fight is even worse because some hospitals or some healthcare authorities have absolutely banned it. Intravenous iron is safe, easy, but expensive. Why is it expensive? Because the drug itself is expensive. So intravenous iron has been bioengineered to make it safe. So some very clever people, and there's two major manufacturers, one in Copenhagen in Denmark and one in Switzerland. Some very clever people bioengineered the drug, and they coated it in a sugar molecule so that your body doesn't recognize this. We do this with a lot of drugs, this bioengineering technique, so that your body doesn't recognize it. So you give it by a drip and your body thinks, oh, this is easy. I'm just getting a sugar solution. And you don't have a reaction to it. So bioengineered iron is very safe. The chance of a serious reaction is tiny, 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 tiny. Intravenous iron 10 or 15 years ago wasn't safe, and it got a very bad name, and it caused a lot of problems. And it's these new formulations that are safe that are very expensive. There is the rub. And they also need to be given in hospital because the MHRA says, even though they're very safe, there's a tiny chance that you need to have an intravenous infusion in the hospital. So they again come back to resource intensive. You need to be in a hospital with a nurse, possibly a doctor, and have an intravenous infusion that takes half an hour, an hour, and have your blood pressure monitored and checked over. So although it is provided by the NHS, it's very expensive. And of course, therefore, they can only provide it to certain patient groups.
So really, unless you're very, very sick, even if you have a ferritin of less than 10, I haven't been offered it. I'm just told to go and take iron tablets.
Which won't work.
Right. So that's not very good then, is it?
No, it's very expensive. So the NHS do offer it to cancer patients who get a lot of iron deficiency as part of their cancer treatment and surgery. They do offer it to kidney patients who have dialysis and chronic kidney disease. They need a lot of intravenous iron. In some parts of the country, they give it to pregnant women who are often very severely iron deficient. And in some parts of the country, they give it to patients who've got very severe gynecological bleeding, you know, very, very heavy periods. And in some parts of the country, they do give it to people with inflammatory bowel disease like Crohn's and ulcerative colitis. But if you took all the women with severe iron deficiency who couldn't take oral iron, you're talking about millions of women. If we do the math, there's 60 million people in the UK, of which 30 million are women. And if we told you that 20% of women have iron deficiency, that's 20% of 30 million. That's 6 million women have iron deficiency.
Is that normally caused by blood loss from periods? Would you say that that is the primary cause of iron deficiency? I'm only asking because then that maybe reduces it slightly. We have only once girls start their periods and only up to menopause. I'm not trying to do the numbers down. It's just, I'm just interested.
Yes, and postmenopausal is much less common. And in children, it's much less common unless their mothers were iron deficient when they were pregnant.
Wow, so you can pass it on because I was iron deficient when I was pregnant.
Your children only get their iron from their mother. There's no other source of anything except from the mother. So B12, iron, all the micronutrients all come from your mother in utero and then from your mother's breast milk.
But they can build it up once they're eating a normal diet.
Yes, but that takes many years. So many children who are born iron deficient don't build it up till they're 4 or 5.
Wow.
So iron comes from your mother and your mother is deficient, the child will be iron deficient when they're born and it takes quite some years to build it up.
Right.
So 6 million women in the UK, so a lot of those will be postmenopause. A lot of them will be children who haven't started periods because they haven't gone through puberty yet. So maybe that would be 3 million who are potentially at risk. And it's not just from periods. You can have no periods. You can be a man and be iron deficient. Men don't have periods. And that would then be because of poor absorption. So it's coming back to the stomach issue. So if you have stomach problems, so inflammatory bowel disease, too much acid, not enough acid, you take proton pump inhibitors to stop your acid production. You have autoimmune disease. Any stomach problem will stop you absorbing iron. And you'll stop absorbing by a proportion. It's not an all or nothing thing, absorption. You might absorb 10% or 20% or 30%. So if I absorb 20% of my dietary intake of iron, and I had a lot of dietary intake of iron, that would be enough as a man who doesn't have periods. But if you absorbed 10% of your dietary intake and that dietary intake wasn't very much because you don't eat meat, then you're talking about only a very tiny amount, which wouldn't be enough for periods. So it's stomach absorption and periods.
So actually with COVID or with long COVID, the impact is double because there's the suggestion that it's had a negative impact on your gut biome. But also from the people that I have spoken to, and certainly from Noreen and I, our blood loss has increased massively.
Correct. So yes, it's a double whammy, Emily. Exactly. It's a double whammy. So you have increased loss and decreased absorption. So you get out of balance, and it's about a weighing scale. So you can't see this, but I'd say you've got increased losses and decreased absorption. So you're out of balance. So your iron levels will go down. And if you were on the borderline before, COVID will push you over the edge. And it's the same with B12, really. If you're on the borderline with poor absorption before and COVID then hits you and you use up your B12 and iron and you don't absorb it, that's what happens to many of my patients. They were probably a little bit iron deficient, let's say a ferritin of 30 before, and they get COVID and then they're very iron deficient. They have a ferritin of 7 or 9, and then they get much worse symptoms. So maybe they were a bit tired and a bit foggy before, and now they have all those symptoms. And that's why they feel so dreadfully, awfully ill. It's like being pushed off a cliff. They were just about coping. Maybe they had a B12 of 300 before, and they had a few symptoms, but didn't really notice much. They get COVID and suddenly they're at 200 or 150 and they feel terrible. Most of my patients had some symptoms before, but didn't really notice it. Okay, this is going to sound really condescending, but it's not meant to be. Busy mums who had iron deficiency, but were just running around all over the place and didn't notice that they felt tired and brain fogged, or just put it down to being normal.
Exactly. You can attribute it to being a busy mother.
Yeah, and that's not meant to be condescending, but you just put it down to something else. And then suddenly you get COVID and suddenly your levels go down and boom, you get this overwhelming symptomatology that just keeps going. And what I found is those with the lowest levels that I see, they have the best response to treatment because I give them iron and B12 and they get so much better.
Right, should we talk about the efficacy then?
Yeah, so I've probably seen about 400 or 500 now. I'm quite selective because I only want to really treat those who I think will get a benefit. There's no point in treating everybody with long COVID because it's a, as you know, because you've been talking about this for a long time, it is a spectrum. And there are many different causes. It's not a single shot, single diagnosis. It's a spectrum. It's a condition with many different contributing factors. And a proportion of patients with long COVID will have very low iron levels, low B12 levels. Remember, I told you the blood tests were both imperfect, but they'll have low levels. And when I treat them, I get rid of those B12 and iron symptoms. And then they get better. But the question is how much better? So for some of them, their B12 deficiency, we treat that and they might get 20% better or 50% better. Or the woman who contacted you, she's like 90% better because really 90% of her symptoms were B12 deficiency. So she still has some fatigue and brain fog as a result of her post-viral syndrome, but most of it was the B12. So really, it's the amount that the iron and the B12 deficiency is contributing to those symptoms. And you don't know that until you try. And that's the problem. There's no sign. There's nothing to tell me how much iron and B12 symptoms they have until you treat them. So you treat the B12 deficiency, you treat the iron deficiency, and then you see how they are. So it is an imperfect treatment. But if I choose the people who have low levels, they get better. And some of them might get 20% better. Some of them might get 50% better. And then some of my patients are 100% better and they're back to work, getting married, having children and doing all sorts of things. You know, I had a lady who had long COVID and was being carried up the stairs by her partner because she couldn't walk up the stairs. She was so weak and had poor sensation in her legs and was awful, horrendously ill. She had B12 and iron. And 2 years later, I saw her a few weeks ago. She's walking up the stairs, 6 months pregnant, having got married to her partner, and is back to work. Wow. Because what she really had was B12 deficiency, not long COVID. That's remarkable.
It really is. It makes it sound like a sort of miracle cure. And yet what you're saying is it's actually something so basic and simple.
It's so easy and basic, B12 and iron deficiency. It's not a miracle at all. It's really just getting those people whose symptoms are B12 and iron deficiency and not long COVID. And that's the rub. And that has to be a clinical diagnosis based on symptoms and based on imperfect blood tests. And it's not a cure for many people.
However, you're not doing down the fact that people have what you said is sort of say termed long COVID. It is still a post-COVID complication. COVID has still driven you into this. So it's not to say that these people have made it up. They don't have long COVID. No. It is a very real impact of having the COVID. But what you're saying is there is a potential fix for some of that impact.
Correct. So long COVID, as we know, is a post-viral fatigue, which is very complicated, has effects on all the body systems, including the gut and including absorption and including gynecological problems as well, as we've discussed. And those can worsen iron and B12 deficiency. But this isn't going to be 100% of long COVID patients. It probably is maybe only 10 or 20% of long COVID patients. But there are a proportion who have B12 and iron deficiency who can get better if they have B12 and iron.
So basically, you're treating a symptom, making them feel better, but the underlying cause, which is the malabsorption, is still there. So you're just going around the malabsorption. You're giving just directly infusing it into the blood.
Well, you've got cause and impact.
Yeah.
And the symptoms are caused by the impact. So I can't treat the cause. The cause is the absorption, which is the microbiome. And probably the best treatment for that is nutrition. So it's looking at things that cause inflammation to the gut. So it might be things like gluten, fructose, which is artificial sugars, lactose, which is cow's milk protein. It might be bacterial overgrowth in the gut. It might be too much acid, too little acid. This is a whole different one-hour conversation about nutrition and the effect on the biome of the stomach. But really, the cause is the poor absorption causing lack of micronutrients. And if you treat the micronutrient deficiency, then some or all of the symptoms will get better. And it's really not complicated or miraculous. It's very simple, really. So as I say, B12 is a simple treatment that's been around for years. And iron is simple but complicated in that you have to give it as an infusion. So you need to be in a hospital, but you only need to give it once.
Yeah.
And that lasts you a few years. So it's kind of easy but hard. And it's expensive. It's £800. So it's super expensive. And there's no hiding away from that cost. Because that cost is the drug and the hospital facility and the nurse and the doctor. So that's expensive. But the B12 is very cheap. It's a couple of pounds a shot from pharmacy, but you have to do it again and again and again and again. So the complexity in the B12 is you're giving a little bit at a time. It takes months and sometimes years to build your levels up, but it's super cheap. So there's one is simple, cheap, but takes a long time. And one is simple, expensive, and is a one-off.
Yeah.
And the facility is not there.
But when I've had these iron infusions, and I've had three now, my levels go right up. And then you can just see them falling over the following 6-8 months.
Yeah. And that's because you're using it up and not absorbing it. So you need it repeatedly.
Yeah. And so this is a brilliant way that we can potentially alleviate ourselves from some symptoms. But what we need to do is still work out what is causing that drop each time and still address whatever's
out. So out is periods. So you need to consider gynecological things to either reduce or stop your periods.
Yeah.
And there's lots of options for that, some of which are simple and some of which are not so simple. And then you need to look at in, which is maximizing dietary intake and improving gut health. So eating an iron-rich diet, but in a way that your body can tolerate it and absorb it, and maximizing gut health by seeing a dietitian or a nutritionist and looking at what makes your tummy better. And of course, when you've got long COVID, both those things are worse and it makes it much more difficult.
Now, in terms of iron absorption, there are some of the oral iron treatments that contain vitamin C, because it says you have to have vitamin C for absorption. What's your tips in terms of what we need to be doing to actually be able to absorb oral iron?
So you need to have iron on an empty stomach between meals with vitamin C. So I say to patients, take it between breakfast and lunch with no tea or coffee 1 hour either side. So that is when your stomach is acidic. When your stomach is empty, between meals, it's acidic and you need acid to absorb iron. And you have it with a glass of orange juice or other juices are available that generally acidify your stomach. Never with a glass of milk or a cup of tea, because that alkalinizes your stomach and you won't absorb the iron from your diet. So you shouldn't have tea or coffee either side of an hour, either side of your meal, because you won't absorb the iron in that meal. So you should be avoiding tea or coffee an hour either side of a meal.
But the rest of the time?
It's okay, but not too much. So the tannins can stop you absorbing iron altogether.
And does that mean, are there negative impacts of things like tea and coffee or any other foods throughout your day that can impact your iron absorption or your iron levels? Are there things that we should be avoiding?
A lot of alcohol can affect the acid in your stomach and stop you absorbing iron. Proton pump inhibitors like omeprazole and lansoprazole, they can stop you absorbing iron. So a lot of people who've been on it for years just don't absorb iron at all. People who have hiatus hernia or acid problems in their stomach may not absorb. So, you know, the stomach is a very delicate part of our body, which is hugely important, and so many things affect it.
Yeah, I can see. It's all a delicate balance.
And that delicate balance is thrown out of the window when you get COVID. And this is the, you know, long COVID, your balance is completely destroyed. And then it has this effect on your body. So it's not illogical. None of this is illogical, and none of this is a miracle. And I'm not looking to cure long COVID, because the underlying causes is something that we can't cure. But in some people with low levels of iron and B12, that complicates the long COVID, makes the symptoms worse, and may cause many of the symptoms. So when you treat the low iron and the low B12, you can make some or many of the symptoms considerably better, and that allows people to heal, to get better. Just gives people some of their energy and some of their brain power and some of their life back.
He gave me a little bit of hope.
They do every week though, Emily. Everybody gives you hope. You need some healthy cynicism.
But that isn't that what we do, like the good cop, bad cop thing? I'm there going, oh, look, it's all sunshine and rainbows. And you're like, really, you need to live in reality.
Fair.
I think the most surprising thing in that was we always talk to people about these arbitrary markers in terms of test results, but his explanation of quite how arbitrary the levels, the ranges that they set are, is really shocking. And the fact that you and I, for example, can't automatically get treated for deficiency because we don't fall into the category of anemia is actually crazy when you look at it. I understand the cost implications, but there are a lot of people who would say, if I'm suffering in the way that someone with diabetes is suffering, should I not be treated?
Yes. And also, again, when you talk about arbitrary levels for B12, for example, if you live in Japan, the threshold is much higher to be B12 deficient compared to here.
Yeah. And I think that the Japanese might be a bit healthier than us as a nation. So yeah. I don't know what that says.
Yeah.
Do you know what I was thinking off the back of this? You and I have a little ladies outing.
We definitely could, but we'd have to stay there for a few weeks, because didn't Dr. Klein say you need to have the injections every other day?
He's going to teach us to self-inject.
Oh, there we go.
Straight away.
Learn a new skill. I was going to learn crochet this week. I could do injections. I'll leave crochet for the following week.
Is that what you were actually going to do this week? Because some people with long COVID have taken up those kind of habits, because there's a lot of benefit from that kind of mindfulness, or where your mind is just focusing on one thing. So it's actually really soothing for your nervous system. So maybe take up crocheting and you might find yourself sleeping.
You know what? I was reading about women who, you know, have been told they're going to get perimenopause, that, you know, they start taking up odd things. You remember I did pottery last term. Last term. So I was thinking perhaps crocheting.
I don't know. I just think pottery is possibly more useful than crocheting. What can you crochet?
Earmuffs, all kinds of things. Tablecloths.
Would you make me some? I have very sensitive ears.
For sure. let's see what next week brings us.
And we've got some really exciting episodes coming up with Rob Wurst, with
David Cutler,
with Thomas Chalemsky, with Connor Brown. We've got all these amazing interviews in the bag that we will get out to you as soon as I can stay off the loo long enough.
God.
Join us next week as we hear others' experiences of long COVID. Share your stories and questions at tlcsessions.net. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram for the latest updates. And if you found this interesting, please do subscribe.